Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
And with that smooth transition, welcome back to the second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show. Martin Tanner, Chris Fredrickson, I'm Bruce Webster. And we're going to start by next segment, toss it over to Martin. Martin, take it away.
Thank you. One of the things that comes up a lot for young people in the church, how do I find good information that will answer my questions? Where should I go? Well, since this is the Interpreter Radio Show sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, one logical source is the Interpreter website. If you go to our foundation's website, there are some fabulous resources that are available. You can search by keywords. So if somebody has some question about something in Joseph Smith's life, type in Joseph Smith and a couple of keywords, and you can find whatever you want. There are many, many other places where you can do similar things. Book of Mormon Central has a wonderful website, and they have a series of know-whys, and it helps you weave your way through with faithful answers to many of the questions that critics come up with and that thoughtful youth in the church have questions about as they read the Book of Mormon and just interact with other people. And Book of Mormon Central is wonderful. You know, that's Book of Mormon Central, Book of Abraham Central, Gospel Central. I mean, they've probably got 40,000 Centrals by now, but it's because they're so wonderful. And I'm being a little facetious, but they're great. Another good resource is FairLatterdaySaints.org. Fair is a place where youth and anyone can click on a website, FairLatterdaySaints.org, and type in any issue, and you will get an answer from over 35,000 entries that respond to questions that have been raised and assertions by critics. It's a wonderful resource. And all of these responses, all of these 35,000 plus responses have been made by faithful Latter-day Saints. And there are some other sources that are great as well. Some of these have been mentioned, the commentaries that have been written by good faithful Latter-day Saints. If you are willing to look or ask somebody, hey, send a question to Interpreter Foundation. They'll find somebody who can give you a great answer to your question. Don't feel shy about it. There are people who live for that, who love to respond to people who have questions, and I'm one of them. So, send in any questions you might have to the Interpreter Foundation, and somebody there will be thrilled to answer your question.
I'll pitch again the Gospel Library app, which almost everyone has. Now, I will admit this. Their search technology has been really bad. it's getting better. The search utility built into the Gospel Library app is getting better.
So the church is true, but the app is flawed.
the app's had its struggles. But I am staggered at the sheer amount of information there. And part of what you need to do, and this is part of, you know, taking the time to study, is literally go through and navigate. You will be surprised at the volume of material that's there, the references that are there, the essays that are there, the scholarly information that is there. It is a tremendous resource, and I think most of us, most members of the church, don't know how to use it most effectively. I'm startled almost every time I go poking through there because I find they've added some new subsection, and they've got, like, you know, 10 levels of pages below that with new things. So that's a resource that's so important, and it's in the palm of your hand. You know, it's much easier to navigate that than the libraries that Chris and Martin and I have and have dragged from place to place. They look nice and so on, but this makes for some very fascinating things. And of course we have, as per Martin, between FAIR, Book of Mormon Central, and Interpreter, there is a profound amount of information. Interpreter for 10 years has been publishing at least one new peer-reviewed article every Friday. They're up to over 500 articles. And the point is that when you run across these questions, there are the resources out there. You just have to know how to look and be willing to look and not be distracted by the TikTok nature of a lot of online criticism of the church. Like, yeah, eat this Tide Pod. It's good for you. You know, you need to get to some really authentic and well-researched sources. Chris, your comments on best resources for answering questions.
I actually just want to, you know, reiterate what you've just mentioned. I would say, too, not only articles the Interpreter has published, but conference proceedings on the conferences are absolutely spectacular to aid our understanding of the gospel, books on various topics, and then movies and documentaries. One of the wonderful things about Interpreter, I think, is the fact that because of the kind of scholarship that is done there, and it's deep dive scholarship, that for many individuals that are involved with other wonderful resources that are available and other, you know, online publications and groups that you have mentioned, a lot of them will turn to the research that's being done by Interpreter scholars to help formulate their ideas and, you know, and the papers that they are writing. So I would reiterate the use of all of those. The one thing that's interesting today is it's not hard to find. You know, I would say also I like a lot of the podcasts that are out there. I really like Follow Him. I'm sure that will continue to be. It's populated generally by scholars, different scholars they bring on that are very helpful. And there's a lot of other really good podcasts out there. But the problem today is not finding the answers. The problem is keeping up with everything that's out there. You can't possibly do it. It's impossible. There is so much good work being done today, and it's available if we take advantage of the opportunity. And, you know, I can do it while I'm making dinner and cutting up vegetables. I can do it while I'm folding clothes. It's not hard to study the gospel these days if we are inclined to do it. It does take some discipline sometimes to break away from, you know, some of the stuff we're watching that perhaps isn't in the long run eternal in nature or to our benefit. But once we start disciplining ourselves, we will certainly feel the benefits and to see the benefits of it in our lives.
Plus, there are other – I was just listening to you, Chris. I was just reminded of Robert Boylan, who we hope to actually have involved with the radio show. He did finally get his visa. I hadn't a chance to tell you that. He got his visa and will be here in early December in the U.S. With a more long-term visa. He won't have to turn around and leave after 90 days. Yeah. Who runs a blog called Scriptural Mormonism, which just makes me feel so inadequate. He posts like twice a day these articles that are quoting, you know, early church fathers or Catholic dissertations on obscure points of theology and so on. You know, he works in Hebrew and works in Greek, and he's this, you know, he's the age, I think he's younger than any of our youngest children. So I just, I feel horribly inadequate whenever I read it. But he's great fun. He does have he started doing podcasts on, video podcasts on YouTube. I had the privilege of being on one of them. So there are tremendous resources out there, but you've got to look. And I really like Martin's suggestion. You know, if you're listening to this, you've immediately got three people, Chris, Martin, and me, that you can ask. If you Google us, you can track us down. You can just go to the interpreter website and submit a question. Ditto for FAIR, ditto for the Book of Mormon Central. There are so many people who know what we're talking about, who have decades of research and reading and study of these topics and can point you and say, hell yeah, this is this. And, you know, this was first raised here and here are some answers. And, you know, here's the latest scholarship on this particular issue. The real deception of a lot of critical commentary and literature is that they never address the actual scholarship, or they make you think it doesn't exist. They make you think, oh, this is a problem, and they're trying to sweep it under the rug because they have no answer for this. Like, you know, I've got half a dozen books on my shelf, you know, bookshelf at home that talk about this issue at some point. And here are, you know, here are 20 articles on Interpreter Foundation, or here, you know, another 15 over at FAIR or at Book of Mormon Central that actually talk about this and talk about it in depth and talk about it with actual information, as opposed to innuendo or distortions. Martin.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, you know, I do this on my other radio show, so here goes. If you have a question and you want to address it to me, martinstanner@gmail.com. Go for it, martinstanner@gmail.com. And if I don't know the answer, I'll find one of the dozens and dozens and hundreds of other people at Interpreter that know far more than I do, but I'm happy to respond to anything.
Okay. Chris, any more comments on the subject?
No. No, that's great.
We're going to change gears a little here, and this is a follow-up to last week's or last month's radio show that the three of us did. I mentioned there that in my stake, I'm the stake Sunday school president, and I had been mandated by the stake presidency to create a mission prep class for young men and young women in the stake. And we ended up doing that. We called a young married couple who both served full-time missions, and they did this series of lessons. They did five lessons the first time they ran it, then they ran it again in July, ran it again in October, and I asked them to cut it down to four lessons. And it's been extremely well received. They've had great turnout. It's very popular and so on. And I got an email on Monday from Brent Holliday, someone whose name I hadn't heard in a long time. Brent and I both served in the Central America Mission back in the early 70s under President Quentin Hunsaker and then President John Eager. And he is now President Holliday. He is president of the Orlando, Florida Temple. And he said, I'd really like to talk to you something about what you had to say. And I called him up, and we had a rather long conversation. It was very enlightening. As a temple president, his concern is that there are too many young people, young men and young women, coming to the temple for their initiatory and endowment work. You know, not the baptisms that they've been doing since they were kids, but actually coming for their own initiatory and endowment work, who are not prepared. And he said, it is more important to have that temple preparation. He's talked about, in you know, the young individuals who he's seen looking absolutely lost during this stuff because they were not prepared at all for what they went through. And he quoted something very interesting. He quoted Elder David Bednar, who pointed out that a mission is not on the covenant path, but the temple is. And that if we prepare our young men and young women for the temple, the missionary work will follow naturally. It will follow as a consequence of their commitment to God and of the inspiration that they can receive. And the more I thought about it, the more I agree with him that we really need this. I actually intend to raise this at High Council meeting on Tuesday with the High Council and the stake presidency, that we should have an equivalent 4-week class, again, aimed at those from 11 on up to temple age, if you will, to, and by temple age, I mean, you know, of an age and in a situation where they're ready to go through and do their own initiatory work and endowment work. And let them, much as with the mission prep, address the basic concepts and issues and let them ask the questions they have. The need for this was reinforced because there was a area training for the Utah area, and one of the issues raised by the Utah area presidency are members of the church, young members of the church who have been through the temple, in some cases have been through missions and so on, but do not understand the covenants they have made, do not understand the proper use of the garments, and who take their temple endowment experience very lightly. So it's clear that there is a need for this kind of preparation. Now, I, my own temple experience, I was, again, only member of my family. I had almost no temple prep before I went through, and I went through actually while I was in the mission home, having left, you know, having now left on my mission. And by mission home at that point, what I mean is that back in 1972, 50 years ago, all missionaries here in the U.S. went first to what was called the mission home, which was a building which is pretty much where the conference center is now. You were there for 5 days. You went through the temple a couple times. You got a question and answer session with the prophet in the solemn assembly room. And then from there, you either went to one of the language training missions or you went straight out on your mission. So I knew very little. I knew a few odds and ends, but generally very little about the temple ceremony. And it was a lot of experience of sort of like, oh, that's interesting. But again, because I had a testimony and such a firm one, it's like, oh, this is, I'm sure there will be things, interesting things I'm going to learn in times to come on this. And I absolutely love the temple. And the, but it's something that we do need to do a better job of preparing our children, perhaps as per the area conference, perhaps instructing some of our adult members on the temple as well. Chris, I'll throw this to you first, and then we'll go to Martin.
Yeah, I'll start by reflecting on my experience. The first time I went to the temple, I had zero preparation, none whatsoever. Had no idea what was going to take place in the temple, and actually I was endowed the day before I was married, and so my head was just spinning anyways, and I remember walking out from the temple after, you know, that experience, and it was like, whatever. I had a testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and it didn't throw me for a loop, but, you know, I continued to be dutiful after we were married and stuff, and we were in the Bay Area, and we went to the Oakland Temple, and we tried to go once a month and, you know, have those experiences there as we moved to Utah. It was a busy time with kids and stuff, but I tried to go a little more often, and then I finally made a commitment I would go at least once a week, and I was by then in the middle of my PhD program with 6 kids and a husband and callings in the church and, you know, studies and stuff. And it was a busy time. And it was hard for me to carve out time to go to the temple, but I had made that promise. But then I started seeing these resplendent blessings after I would leave the temple. You know, I was working on my dissertation particularly, and I was working with, oh gosh, a couple of hundred books and articles. And, you know, I had stuff spread out all over my office and books all over my shelves. And I would literally sometimes come home and a thought would pop into my head or a quote, and I could just reach up on the shelf and pull off the book, and there was what I needed. And I couldn't write fast enough the thoughts that were popping into my head with regards to my dissertation when I made that kind of sacrifice, because it was a sacrifice. It was a hard thing to do when I was so busy to go to the temple. And my love for the temple grew as I began to study. And, you know, there are things mentioned in the temple, especially now and when we do initiatory, there are scriptures that are quoted in the temple. And so we can go to those scriptures which elaborate, and we can better understand some of the promises and blessings. And as we pay attention, you know, and as we listen, and as we focus and understand that everything points to Jesus Christ, then we're going to get a profound testimony, not only of Jesus Christ, but of his work and his mission. And then everything that we read, Old Testament, New Testament, we're going to see so much there that is a temple, you know, that points us to the temple, that is referencing the temple and the blessings, because it's in temples where we make enduring covenants, eternal covenants with our Father in heaven. And so it's been a lifelong process for me, but now I love the temple and I'm so grateful that we are privileged to live in a day and age when temples are dotting the earth again, and where we can go in and not only do work for ourselves, but there's that promise of being saviors on Mount Zion and doing work for others. And so I think it helps us if we, you know, bear testimony of that. But I think young people today, a lot of them go in with sort of presuppositions, and much of what's taking place in temples is uncomfortable to them because they don't understand that there's a lot of ritual in the church, but particularly for those that grew up in the church, because you do it over and over again, you don't see it as ritual. The sacrament is a ritual. It's very symbolic. It has some deep-seated meaning. But because we take the sacrament every week, we don't think of it as a ritual, and yet it is. So we do have ritual in the church, but then we go into the temple, and a lot of people are knocked off their feet because we are certainly, in many respects, a material paganistic society, and we just don't do a lot of ritual performance. And so that's hard for young people. And so I reiterate what you're saying, Bruce. I think it's imperative that young people get good instruction before they go to the temple. There's some good books, Holy Temple by K. Packer. Who wrote Jesus the Christ? I'm brain dead tonight. Talmage has written about, I mean, there's so much out there now that, again, is instructive and helps and prepares us for the temple. And those classes are needed, and but mostly, you know, just bear your testimony to these young people that there's going to be a lot that might throw you that you're not going to understand, but stick with it, and you will start to see the most extraordinary blessings. And I work in the temple, and I can promise you every week when I go into that temple, as I am in the Savior's house, we see miracle after miracle after miracle, and I hear the most beautiful stories of how names are gathered, how work has, you know, been able to be facilitated because of miracles that have happened in people's lives. People come and we're not prepared for certain things, and suddenly we have that language speaker right there at the veil, and, you know, on and on and on. And so it's just an extraordinary place. But if nothing else, go into the temple and feel the peace and the spirit that is there. Just let go of everything. And, you know, I used to rush to the temple and I would carve out time. But now that I work in the temple, I'm in there for several hours. And to be able to kind of decompress and to just exude in that spirit, there's nothing quite like it. And you do go armed out, as the promise is given in the Doctrine and Covenants, empowered, you know, empowered from on high. God empowers us every time we go to the temple and participate in those sacred holy rituals.
Thank you. Martin, your thoughts?
I'm going to start with now and move back to where the endowment sort of came from, but of course, very briefly. If you look at society today and the context in which the youth of the church are growing up, you see far less of an emphasis on clothing for certain circumstances than you ever have in the past, which is quite ironic because in many ways church members are affluent compared with the way they were in the 1800s when they were literally destitute. But so you have youth who you see, unless they're blessing or passing the sacrament, show up to sacrament meeting in tennis shoes, maybe no tie, different. It's dress codes have become lax, and especially in the era of COVID. People can go to work now in their pajamas. They stand up and walk across the room and sit down on the internet. The idea that clothing is special and makes a statement is slipping away. But if you can grasp that idea and move earlier in time and understand the purpose of clothing, and in this case garments, because we're talking about the temple, it begins to make sense. If you were going to get married to somebody, unless you really didn't take it seriously, you'd probably dress up in the nicest stuff you had to wear. Why? Because that's an important moment in your life, and you want to dress your best to make it seem important to you and to the person you're marrying. And if you're even just there as a witness, the same thing applies. Take that concept and move it into the temple, and you start to grasp the importance of something that is kind of a shock to young people who go in there, which is, what's all this stuff I'm wearing? Every single thing that you wear in the temple, you know, robes and all the details, which I won't go into here, have a special sacred meaning. And they are very uniform, so that there aren't people with high status or low status. Everyone is dressed the same. And that takes away the distractions of the person who might, oh, look at the gold cufflinks, or look at the gold chains, you know, rap artists and whoever else. All of that is gone. The person with the, you know, $900 alligator shoes, that's not in the temple. Everybody has simple white shoes. And as you go through and understand that concept and the purposes behind all of the things that one wears, there are purposes behind it. One is modesty. Garments have a function of modesty, and the clothing in the temple have a function of modesty. They also have, because of the marks in them, reminder of covenants that you make. And so there's a purpose to these. They weren't just tossed together. There's serious sacred thought that goes into it. Another one is that you have the garment as protection, and it's promised to be a protection to you, maybe physically, but also mentally and from evil. It's a lot less easy to do something bad if you're wearing your garments and think about them than it would be without them, to be blunt. And then you have the idea of garments as sacred objects. People who go through the temple, before they wear a garment, they're washed, anointed, and pronounced clean. And that cleanliness compared with the outside world is something that the garment is supposed to be a reminder of. And so that's the short overview of the clothing. When you get to the interior of the temple and all the things that happen in there, if you understand the basic concept that it's all chronological. If it starts at the beginning and goes through the creation, through to the ultimate end in the celestial kingdom, and explains to you the foibles that can happen along the way and the ways to keep yourself pure and good and in the right direction with that ultimate goal in mind, the symbolism will make sense. And that's the crux of it. There's really no more to the big outline than that. But if you don't understand that, you will go in and be lost the same way that I was in my very first day of calculus. And I when I was not as prepared as I should have been. I did catch up, but and you can too if you've already been through the temple without a good background and grounding. But the other comment is the church is much more open today about what goes on in the temple than it ever has been. It used to be people were very reluctant to talk about the clothing, talk about the garments, talk about anything in the interior of the temple. Now you can find all kinds of books that have photos.
Well, the church has photos on its website.
Yes.
Of garments and temple robes.
Yes, exactly. And so you can find all that stuff.
Yeah.
And the only thing that now is still considered sacred and not utterable outside is the actual wording of the ceremonies.
Aspects, yeah. To harken back, I'll get back to you, Chris, but to harken back to something you said, I had the great privilege and blessing. My gosh, this is going to be 2005, 2006, around there. We had just moved to Colorado, and I was called as the gospel doctrine teacher. I was the only gospel doctrine teacher. I got to teach it every week, and I got to teach all of the Old Testament and all of the New Testament. It was probably my single favorite stint of church service in my life. And what you know, doing my own deep dive as I was going through this and, you know, trying to really understand what I was going through in both the Old and New Testament, I would almost every week in part of our teaching saying, those of you who have been through the temple, look at this verse, look at this language, look at this concept. And once you have been through the temple and start to study and think about the temple, you will find it pervades the scriptures. And we have outstanding Latter-day Saint scholarship on the temples, multiple books covering it. Anyway, and Chris, I'll turn it back to you now.
Yeah, I was just going to say one thing to show how, again, well, I'll give you a perfect example. So in the modern world, because of some of the, I wrote an article a number of years ago when I was writing for Mormon Times for Deseret News, and I talked about veiling, the practice of veiling among Islamic women, Muslim women. And I explained that it's no different. They're veiling by these women when it is a choice, not when it's forced upon them, like they're doing in Afghanistan again today and in some other countries, but when it's not forced, but when it's a free will choice, it's a way that they express and show their devotion and to the Savior, to God, to Allah. And so, but in the modern world where in some instances it's been forced on women, veiling has come to be seen as an expression of that demeans women, that puts women in a subservient position. But anciently, actually, when you look at ancient Mesopotamia, when you look at much of the iconography back from the ancient world, one of the things that they are beginning to recognize is that veiling was an identifier of a woman who was a queen or a priestess. Now, just let that sink in for a moment. So when women think about it, when this practice is part of the temple worship, it's perhaps that's what it is helping us to understand the possibilities of our becoming queens and priestesses. And veiling is an identifier of our potential in that regard. And so there's so much about the temple, again, that is related to that ancient world and our study of, you know, as Bruce just mentioned, so much great scholarship on the temple these days. And actually one of the great scholars that the church loves to death is Margaret Barker, and she has done some great work. But in the LDS church today, we have some extraordinary temple scholars.
I will mention one experience I had. I had one class from Hugh Nibley as an undergrad on the Book of Enoch, and summer school class. Was spring or summer term in the old Joseph Smith building, which I don't think had air conditioning going, and so it was. And the registration was actually supposed to be like 11 people, and there were probably 50 of us in there. So he's up there teaching, and it's it's a little warm and it's afternoon and, you know, it's kind of keep your eyes open. And he started quoting, I believe it was from the Apocalypse of Abraham or Apocalypse of Adam. And he starts talking about three messengers coming down to Adam and Eve. And all of a sudden around the classroom, you can see about half of the class suddenly lifting their heads and looking at him as he continues to read from this. And I'm like, wait a second, we recognize this. Martin, any last comments on this before we go to our next segment?
I'm good.
Okay.